How does an 11-year-old get the idea and have the chutzpah to crash the gates of the fashion world?
I don't really know why I think I can do anything that I do. Probably good parenting. I know that I'll be okay.
Today in Studio 360, I'll talk with Tabi Gevinson, Wunderkind. First, she had a successful fashion blog. Now she's editing her own magazine, acting in movies, and headlining a Broadway play. And she only just graduated from high school. Plus, the jazz composer Maria Schneider, who is reinventing what big band music sounds like.
I didn't want the music always to be that in-your-face blast.
That and more is all ahead today in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC, right after this.
Studio 360 is supported by TiVo, unifying cable, on-demand, and streaming apps like Netflix without the need to switch TV inputs, remotes, or user experience. Learn more at TiVo.com. And by Lumosity.com, personalized brain training programs developed by neuroscientists to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving through games. Learn more at Lumosity.com.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. This summer, we've been asking for poems from high school students for our latest extra credit listener challenge, and today we'll find out the winner. Plus, I'll get a little music theory lesson from Maria Schneider, the terrific band leader and composer. That's all ahead this hour. But before we get to poetry and music, one of the strangest art world stories I've ever heard. When it comes to art forgers, few have been as prolific or duped as many museums as Mark Landis.
46 museums in 20 states with more than 100 pieces that he's offered up to these institutions.
For almost 30 years, Landis has been recreating works of all kinds of artists, from lesser-known Impressionists to Picasso to Walt Disney. But he doesn't try to sell his forgeries. He donates them. And he's fooled museums all over the country into accepting them as gifts. But in 2007, he tried to hoax the wrong museum. At the Oklahoma City Museum of Art, the registrar got suspicious about Landis's donations. And he, a guy named Matthew Leininger, started an investigation that led to Landis's exposure as a fraud. It's one of the most curious forgery cases in art history, I think. Landis never received a penny for his forgeries and has never been prosecuted. Landis and the unraveling of his 30-year con are the subject of a fascinating new documentary called Art and Craft, which comes out later this month. The forger Mark Landis and Sam Coleman, one of the film's directors, are here with me today. Welcome to Studio 360.
Thanks for having us.
So, Mark, watching this documentary, it was so surprising to me both how quickly you work and do these pictures and the incredibly common materials you use. Like, you were buying stuff at Hobby Lobby to forge apparently convincing Picassos. Talk about process and the tools.
Oh, sure. Well, all that really counts is what it looks like, you know. When you go to a museum, you don't put it under one of those giant microscopes.
No, but you expect the museums to.
That they have down in the basement of museums. And I've been in plenty of them.
Yeah.
I mean, after all, when you meet people, you don't x-ray them or anything, right? It's like a magic trick. Let's put it, that's a good, it's like a magic trick.
Right.
Yeah, if it looks convincing.
Except, never believe that a magician is really performing magic.
Yeah, you're right. That was a bad one.
That's all right. I want to talk about the stuff you use, though. I mean, you're shown using felt-tip pens and putting, like, crappy dime store frames around
them. I like things that are easy, because if there is such a thing as an attention deficit disorder, I've got it, because I've got to get things done really fast. A movie starts on TV, and I like to have it done by the time the movie's over, you know.
Really? So, really, a picture takes you only a couple of few hours?
Yeah, at best.
How did you learn to do it?
Well, I grew up in Europe in the 60s, and mother and dad used to like to travel around.
And he was a naval officer, right?
That's right. He worked for NATO. Anyway, we'd go to museums during the day and course, we'd bring back catalogs and things. And then they'd like to go out, and I'd be left alone in a hotel room. And they didn't have TVs in the hotel rooms yet.
Right.
But I did have the catalogs to go through. And like all kids, you know, you draw pictures. And I started copying pictures out of the catalogs.
So once you decided, hey, I'm going to do these and give them away to museums, how did you and how do you decide what works to forge?
Oh, okay. Well, to begin with, it was an impulse way back in 85 or 86. And everybody was just so nice and treated me with respect and deference and friendship. Things I was...
Because they thought you were rich and generous.
Yeah, things I was very unused to. Actually not used to at all. And I got addicted to it. And to answer the second part of your question, okay, before I subscribed to the internet and everything, I had to rely on the museum directory at the library. The main thing is you try and find out a little bit about the museum and what they collect, because you have to give them something they want, you know, something that they specifically collect.
And then once you decide, okay, that this is the kind of thing they want, do you say, oh, I love this picture? Or is it all about making the...
No, you have to find some. Well, preferably find something that you like doing. But the main thing is something that they will want, you know.
Right. And the first one you ever did was what?
Oh, that was easy. A Maynard Dixon Indian. Maynard Dixon was... really big. And this is California, okay? In case people aren't familiar with him, he was a cowboy artist. He did Indians, and he was really big in the 80s. And there had been a show at the Legion of Honor Museum. And that's why I chose Oakland, because they had such a big collection of Maynard Dixon drawings of Indians. I thought it'd be better to go to the other one. Because after all, it was my first time, and I'd have been nervous that they might, you know, but everything went fine. And everybody was, as I said, so nice and treated me like a king for a day.
Right. And as you say, you got addicted, understandably,
right,
to this. And so for 20 years as you did this, nobody ever said, wait, we got to check this out, or I'm not sure.
Well, no, they did. But what I cared about was that they didn't get around to doing it until I was long gone.
Right.
Yeah.
And I guess if they ever were suspicious, they would probably keep it quiet since they didn't pay anything for it.
Yeah. Well, sometimes they did and sometimes they didn't. I mean, I do have a collection of stiff letters, but...
What does stiff letters mean?
Oh, just, you know, the usual thing. Thank you very much for your interest in our museum. We have decided to deaccession such and such and remove it from our permanent collection. You know, that sort of... That's what I mean, sincerely. That's a stiff letter.
Sam, when you tracked Mark down to Mississippi and told him you were working on this documentary... As I understand it, he immediately said he spilled the beans, right? And showed you how he does it.
Well, it wasn't immediate. Mark spent some time vetting us on the phone. But you're right. It's true. When we met Mark with camera in tow, he was incredibly forthcoming for a guy in his position. He wanted to tell us everything, and he let us film him making the copies and eventually, pretty soon thereafter, giving them away.
And was that, Mark, because you thought, okay, this has gone on long enough. This is a new fun piece of this adventure?
No. Actually, it's like most things. There's always a simple answer. I'm a lonely old shut-in, and I really appreciated
attention.
Having some chic young filmmakers from New York City come to spend some time with me and become friends to me.
Sam, the film also follows Matthew Leininger, who was the registrar at the Oklahoma City Museum of Art, who first got suspicious about Mark's donations. The New York Times describes Matt Leininger as the Javert to Mark's Jean Valjean, the police inspector and thief from Les Miserables. I definitely see the Javert in Leininger, but since Mark is a career deceiver, I mean, isn't he more like a Dostoevsky character or something? I mean, because he's not an innocent.
No, Mark's not an innocent. I think he will eventually take responsibility for what he's done in conversation. But, you know, I do think what is remarkable about Mark and what made his story so intriguing to us is that I don't think there was malice in his actions. You know, when we first met him, he was genuinely upset to hear that he had caused people some anguish.
So why do you think Matt Leininger picked up on this thing that all these dozens of experts for years and years had not?
Well, Mark is remarkable for many, many reasons. One of them is that as a forger, he copies a huge range of things. He's made copies from 15th century icons all the way to Picasso and Walt Disney and everything in between. That's unusual for people who make copies. The other thing that is unusual that Mark did, which also I think resulted in Matt finding him out, is that he made multiple copies of the same work and gave them to the different places across the country. And by the time the internet age came about, Matt, when he received one of the gifts, looked it up and found out, hey, that's in a couple other institutions. There's something wrong here.
And because he didn't sell them, because he donated them, that's explains why he's here rather than in jail, I guess.
That's right. Mark walks free.
And when you were doing this, were you conscious of the legal issues and, oh, if I just give them away, I'll never be get in trouble?
I guess I just didn't really think about it much.
Really?
Yeah.
Huh, interesting.
I mean, I'd have known that if I was selling, because I've seen enough
right.
TV, but yeah, you're right. Yeah, I didn't think I'd get into trouble. No,
right.
I thought they'd just get mad and
right.
send stiff letters, and I'd be long gone by the time
yeah.
they got mad, so,
yeah.
you know.
And so you concocted all these false identities as the philanthropist in these various museums, but you also donated works using your own name.
Oh, yeah, I started out doing that, yeah. But then when I thought gossip was getting around, because you know what they say about things being this business is a small world. Everybody knows everybody in this business. So I was afraid gossip was getting around.
Uh-huh.
So I thought I had better start using different aliases and things.
We see you in the film going to see mental health professionals and talking about your various diagnoses for schizophrenia and other things. Do you ever think of this adventure, these forgeries, as some symptom of illness or not?
I never thought of it in that way, no. And I don't even know if any of that stuff's wrong with me.
At what point, Sam, in the making of the film, did you become aware of this history of quote-unquote mental illness, and did that change the way you were thinking about Mark and his story?
Definitely, many of those things. So we were introduced to the story actually through Matt Leininger. When the Times wrote the piece that inspired Jennifer to contact me and to go out and try and make this film, they had not talked to Mark yet. They described him as large, sort of trumping up the dramatic aspects of him being this big bad guy out there in the world. And by the time we tracked down Matt, was speculating a lot about, there had been rumors, you know, is Mark ill? Is he dangerous? You know, there was like a lot of like fear about that. And of course, when we got to meet Mark, none of that was really accurate. But we did get Mark to talk about his family, his past, and also his mental illness. And that certainly did change what we thought we had. You know, the film sort of starts off as this art caper, a cat and mouse chase, and it becomes something much broader, I think, once we learn who Mark is.
So a couple of years ago, there was a show of your work in Cincinnati, organized by the University of Cincinnati and by Matt Leininger, who busted you, called Faux Real. Now there's this big documentary that we're talking about here. This has all panned out pretty well for you, hasn't it?
Yeah, door of opportunity opens both ways. Because I remember when, you know, I first found out I was in trouble, I was pretty down because I was thinking, gee, what am I going to do? You know, I can't just sit around in my room watching TV the rest of my life, you know? I mean.
Yeah. So this must be fun.
Now?
Yeah.
Well, yes, so far, yeah.
Are you still making pictures?
Yeah. People have been letting me do their grandchildren and children, and when they go on a vacation, like to Europe, they bring back things and they want paintings of. And then, you know, the churches in Laurel have had me do things for benefit auctions, which gives you a boost, you know, to your self-esteem.
Right.
Yeah.
Still doing forgeries, though?
Oh, no.
No?
No, not unless somebody asks me to.
Right. Yeah. You're not deceiving anyone?
No, not really.
Or so you claim.
Not really.
Not really?
No more than anybody else.
Well, Mark, it has been a pleasure talking to you, and good luck with how you spend this incredibly active retirement.
Thank you for everything.
And Sam Coleman, thank you as well.
Thanks for having us.
Art and Craft, the documentary about Mark Landis, is out in theaters later this month. And if you'd like to hear my entire conversation with Mark Landis and see a slideshow of some of his forgeries, go to studio360.org. All summer long, high school-age writers have been sending us their poems, submitting them for our latest Extra Credit Listener Challenge. We got more than 600 submissions, which, by the way, is a Studio 360 record for a challenge. And today, we're ready to find out who won our Battle of the High School Bards. With me now is our judge, the poet and Columbia University professor, Dorothea Lasky. Dottie, welcome back to Studio 360.
It's great to be back.
Thank you for going through this deluge of entries. We got a lot of submissions, as I said. The assigned theme was summer, and a lot of the poems naturally fell into a few general subject areas. After culling through so many, did you find that you were more drawn to certain styles or themes or approaches?
I was really drawn to heartbreak, because that's the kind of thing that I love. So those are the ones that I picked out as top ones.
So you have picked a winner, right?
I have picked a winner, a clear winner.
Well, here is an excerpt from that winning poem by Timmy Okadina from Illinois. It's called Our Urban Educational Systems.
My mama said, education is how you can empower your dreams. Dreams the youth has awakened from, but still searching, trying to recollect. Asking, why did they wake us up? Society and all. They put the power into the system and stripped away the outlying insulation, daring us kids to fall. And they promised. They said, keen is the knowledge. And so we pride ourselves in what we know, and hope is not always belief.
So when you say he was the clear winner, there were other good poems, but it was, nope, that's the one. What made it so, and what made the runners-up such a relatively distant second place?
Well, they were all so wonderful, but I felt that Timmy had a great sense of sound, which I think is what a poet needs more than anything else, and it was just so distinct. And I think, of course, he was in an advantage by taking all that time and work, you know, to do the background sound with it, so that made it even more obvious, but just like the beats and the way that he had a sense of the way words fit together was so clear.
And the fact that it wasn't in any obvious sense about summer, that didn't, Professor Lasky didn't say you've disobeyed.
I liked that it wasn't exactly about summer. There was, he was in the presence of summer when he wrote it and thinking about the past or the future and just what that meant. But I liked that little twist.
So should we call him and tell him he's won?
Yeah, let's call him.
Hello?
Hi, is that Timmy?
Yes, this is Timmy.
Hi, how are you? This is Kurt Anderson from Studio 360.
I'm doing good. How are you?
Good. I'm here with Dorothea Lasky, who's a professor at Columbia and our judge for this contest. And I also want to let you know that you actually are the winner of the contest.
Wow, that's great news.
And I will let her tell you why she picked you.
Congratulations. It was so wonderful listening to your entry and just reminded me of a young Gertrude Stein, and I was so excited to just hear how different your work was. What's your inspiration for the poem?
I guess mostly just my observations of just walking through the inner city streets and the everyday life. And I guess maybe if you want to say poet that I like to listen to was Gil Scott-Heron.
I knew what I was going to say, that I saw so many threads
of
that. And
you sampled him a little bit in the production, right?
Yeah, I did.
I assume you're the product of an urban educational system?
Yeah, I just graduated high school.
And now that you're in college, for a few days anyway. do you know what you're going to be studying?
Yes, I am. I'm doing a double major, illustration and human resource management.
Wow, that's an interesting double major.
What are your illustrations like?
They're mostly to go along with my poems and stuff I write.
So. Did you do an illustration for the winning poem?
Yes.
That would be a cool thing to do, like a little book or something, right?
Yeah, that's what I'm hoping to do, stuff like that.
Well, good luck with that. And your poem, your winning poem, and your illustration that goes with it is going to be up on our website.
Thank you guys so much.
You're more than welcome. Thanks for your poem, and congratulations.
All right, no problem.
Congrats, Timmy.
See you. Bye.
That's it, our most entered listener challenge ever. And Dottie Lasky, thank you so much for taking on the incredibly heavy duty of being the judge.
Oh, it was a great burden in many ways.
You mean a great burden?
But both ways.
Exactly. And thank you to all the hundreds of you who submitted your poems to the challenge and to the Scholastic Art and Writing Awards for being our co-presenters. Dottie Lasky's new book of poems is out now and called Rome. Coming up, the blogger known as Style Rookie, Tavi Gevinson, became a figure in high fashion even as she was attending junior high school.
Oh, I was in New York 24 hours ago, and now I'm in math class, and people are looking at me funny.
I'll talk with Tavi Gevinson next in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
Studio 360 is supported by TiVo. No need to switch TV inputs, remotes, or interfaces to access cable TV and streaming from Netflix and Hulu Plus. Learn more at TiVo.com. And by Lumosity.com, personalized brain training programs developed by neuroscientists to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving through games. Learn more at Lumosity.com.
This is Studio 360, and I'm Kurt Anderson, your host. And I say that because for only the second time since we've been on the air, I'll be handing over the keys to Studio 360, and I'll be leaving everything in the hands of an incredibly talented, charismatic, versatile, intelligent guy.
Hello?
Hi, is that Alan Cumming?
Yes, it is.
Hello, Mr. Cumming. This is Kurt Anderson.
Hi, Kurt. How are you?
I'm very well, and I'm still curious about why you agreed to do this, frankly. I shouldn't look this gift horse in the mouth, but you're...
I don't know either, Kurt. It was a really foolish, precious moment, and I'm totally regretting it.
No, it'll be easy. It'll be easy, and you've got nothing else to do, just 8 shows a week on Broadway.
And filming a TV series, yeah. You know, I just had such a great time when I came. It's rare that you go on a show as an interviewee and have actually a proper, intelligent, thought-provoking chat, and... You know, that's the experience I had when I came on your show. And so when I was asked to do it when you were away, I really thought that would be fascinating for me to be at the other side of that and have a chat with some people that I find really fascinating.
Aw, shucks. Well, you will be fascinating. But, of course, you have to speak in a perfect American accent now.
Oh, gosh. Darn it. I can't.
There you go. Are there any guests in particular that you're going to try to rope into being on with you?
Well, there's a photographer that I know who's called John Dugdale, who's actually blind, and he's just someone I've been fascinated with for years and slightly in awe of, actually. And also my old friend Cindy Lauper is going to grace us with some of her wit and wisdom. So it's a nice mixture of people. I'm very excited.
I have been seeing that you tweet pictures from your dressing room at Cabaret night after night. Is it true or a joke that you have this nightly after party sponsored by Campari?
It's true. It's called Club Cumming, and I invite members of the cast up, and on Wednesday I make soup on matinee days in my crock pot, and we have a soup and booze party. And then, you know, what's great now is that other people from other Broadway shows drop in. I even have a neon sign in the window now, so that if friends come by, if the Club Cumming signs on, it means that party's still going.
You are such a brand extender. First fragrance, now this?
You know, I can't help it if my lifestyle is so conducive to endorsement.
Exactly. Well, you're going to have to bring your own Campari to Studio 360 because it's Dixie cups and bad coffee.
Yes, I can imagine. I remember.
And while I'm gone and while you're here, back in Scotland, they're going to be voting on independence.
Indeed. And I'm a yes you know, September the 18th is the actual date of the referendum. It's so close right now. It's impossible to call, actually. It's a very exciting. I mean, I think whatever happens, Scotland will be changed forever because people have really altered their kind of experience of what Scotland is and what Scotland could be just by the conversation and the debate that's been going on over the last year and a half. So,
and
it's
maybe
a very exciting time, and I'm obviously very fingers crossed that we are going to be independent once more.
At the very least, no American will ever call you English again.
That's partly the reason I'm doing it, yeah, actually. It is really funny. People say to me, I'm so sorry I called you British. I'm like, no, I am British right now, but English was much more insulting.
Yeah. Well, if I decide not to come back from my time away, you're good to just keep doing this for indefinitely,
you know,
right?
I've got it down, I think. You just get interesting people and you just ramble on, and they'll fix it in post.
Exactly. You figured it out. I'm so pleased you're going to be doing this, and have fun.
I will, and have a lovely working holiday and eat a lot of delicious Umbrian delicacies.
I promise. Thank you.
All right, Kurt, bye.
Bye. You can hear Alan Cumming as guest host of Studio 360 in just a couple of weeks.
Come on, baby, won't you be my guest? Join the party and meet the rest. Everything is going to be so right. Just be my guest tonight.
About 6 years ago, when my daughter Lucy was 18, she introduced me to a fashion blog by a girl in suburban Chicago named Tavi Gevinson. Tavi had started Style Rookie at age 11, and it made her kind of famous among the cool kids in New York and Los Angeles. She was embraced by the designers behind Rodarte and invited to New York fashion shows and treated like a celebrity. Although there were kids at school who rolled their eyes at her, and people in fashion and the media, even before she got out of high school, were wondering if she'd peaked too early. Well, Tavi Gevinson is an adult now, 18, and her remarkable ascent continues. Her blog has morphed into a full-fledged online magazine for teenage girls called Rookie, and it turns out Tavi Gevinson is also an actor, by which I don't mean had a part in a play last spring at Oak Park and River Forest High School. No, she is now starring in a play on Broadway called This Is Our Youth. It's set in the early 1980s, and it's about three kids growing up privileged and confused.
What you're like now has nothing to do with what you're gonna be like. Like, right now, you're all like this rich little pot-smoking burnout rebel, but 10 years from now, you're gonna be like a plastic surgeon reminiscing about how wild you used to be.
Well, I don't want to.
And Tavi Gevinson is here with me now. Welcome to Studio 360.
Thank you for having me.
So you are really amazingly good in this role.
Thank you.
So good. You really made my daughter adore and envy you all the more. The director of the play, Anna Shapiro, says that you in real life are nothing like the character you play in This Is Our Youth, Jessica Goldman. Is that true?
I definitely relate to Jessica in many ways. I think so much of the play is about coming out at the end of your teen years and you're not quite an adult yet and you're in this strange in-between. I stopped going to school about 2 weeks before everyone else in my grade because rehearsals started in May. And because I run this website Rookie, which is for teenage girls, like being a teenager and thinking about adolescence and writing about it and curating all this artwork about it has been so much of my identity. And so by the time the play started, I felt like maybe not, you know, by experience, but just through feelings in the same boat as Jessica, my character. You know, it's like I had a lot of ideas about who I had been and a lot of memories, but I had no concept of who I would become. And like, I think every day about how glad I am that I'm not in high school anymore.
Glad you're not in high school because you're freer to do what you want, or because the standard American high school scene was not your scene?
I really appreciated high school for what it was. I'm really glad I did it. I'm glad I never, like,
I'm
did
glad
homeschooling.
You did it too. Yeah.
Well, because, you know, there were times when it seemed like, oh, why can't I just work full time?
Right.
But it's like, I'm glad I did it, but I'm even happier that I'd no longer have to negotiate.
Right.
Like, oh, I was in New York 24 hours ago and now I'm in math class and people are looking at me funny.
Right. Your character, Jessica, frets about how the adult version of her will be different than the 19-year-old version of her and talks to another of the characters about this. She imagines, she says, that it'll be like finding an old letter she wrote and not being able to connect with that person.
Yes.
or those thoughts. When, for instance, you look at your old blog-style rookie, do you ever think like, whoa, that's a different person than I am now?
Yes, it's wild. It's like the first time you're able to do that, to look at an old picture of yourself and be like, that's me. That was my body. How weird.
Yeah.
I think I'm less scared of that part of life than Jessica is. I find it really freeing. I really like that I'll go through as many changes as I already have.
So you were, as a little kid in third grade and so on, into mm-hmm. musicals. And then you decided with Rookie, okay, no, it's fashion and style that really interests me. What accounted for that switch in sort of the focus of your sensibility?
When I started my blog, I was at the end of my sixth grade. And middle school is a really hard time, as we all know. And I felt like I had been rejected by that group. I wasn't cool enough for this group. Okay, well then, like, screw it. I'm going to repel everyone. So I became really interested in fashion, and especially in, like, really ugly, you know, conventionally ugly or unflattering designers and collections. And in seventh grade, like, for as much as it sometimes stung to be kind of bullied, it was also kind of like, yeah, bring it on. Like, I'm thickening my skin, which was probably really good practice for everything I do now.
So then, after this amazing success between ages 11 and 14, you decided to change course in your media enterprise?
Yeah. I mean, I started Rookie 3 years ago. And basically stopped writing my blog at the same time. And Rookie is, you know, for teenage girls, so there's a bit of fashion.
Right,
but I think the strongest parts of the site are just, I hate to, it's such a magazine term, but like real life issues.
Yeah. For instance, how to think about community college, or in this new issue about Michael Brown's killing in Ferguson.
Yeah.
Do you have models in terms of girl women's magazines for what you're trying to do?
I think I actually created Rookie because I didn't feel like there was anything like it.
Because Sassy had gone out of business?
Sassy went out of business, but I also felt like there were issues with Sassy that could be updated. Through blogging, I had met all these young writers and illustrators and photographers, and I felt like we just needed a home base and a community and a way then to lift up other young women who were trying to get their work out there.
And what did you feel wasn't being done by the existing media?
I don't know, just normal, like, talking like a person. You know, I never wanted to create some kind of, like, binary of, like, well, you have all these, like, mainstream girls' magazines and we're, like, alternative.
Right.
I just wanted something that could just be nice and honest and normal and, you know, we wouldn't be relying on advertisers, so we could do whatever we want.
Right. So sometime in the last year, Rookie is going great guns, and you're in your senior year in high school. You decide to go for a role in this play that's going to be on Broadway. How did you know or think you were ready for that?
I don't really know why I think I can do anything that I do. Probably good parenting. I know that I'll be okay. Even if I audition for this part and I'm rejected, my life will stay the same as it was.
Right.
Yeah.
At one point, you start dancing.
Mm-hmm.
Was that particularly nerve-wracking, or did that come easily too? Because you're a good dancer, by the way.
Thank you.
But maybe it's just me. But that seems like it would have been a hard thing to suddenly do and do proficiently, almost alone on stage.
I don't know. You don't have a choice. It's not you. It's not personal.
Yeah.
If I look like a dummy dancing, I'm wearing a mask, so like it's fine. That's part of why I do it. It's like, this is a time where you don't have to be yourself and think about yourself as much as I do in my writing and everything.
Yeah.
So it's really nice to just go out there and feel somewhat fearless and know that I'm not doing it for myself. I'm doing it for Jessica and for Warren and for this beautiful, beautiful play that we get to bring to life.
Do you, as you look at magazine editors, actors, do you have models of, that career, that person, that looks like something I'd like to follow in terms of my trajectory?
Oh, yes, absolutely.
Who?
Susan Sontag. And there's a really wonderful essay about her by Wayne Kostenbaum in a book called My 1980s and Other Essays, where he spends a great deal of it just talking about how she refused to restrict herself. And for me, I mean, it's not so much about seeing, like, how many different things can I try and
right.
how many trades can I have. It's just, this is a thing I want to do, so I'm going to do it. I mean, it's taken a while for me to get out of the headspace of, like, oh, but I'm a writer, and, like, I'm an introvert, and I don't perform. But then I do perform. I love it. I love doing this play. I think when we have those identity crises, we're just limiting ourselves, and it has nothing to do with the physical world. And so I just have to kind of start my day by listening to Kanye West, and then I feel confident enough to do anything.
Well, Susan Sontag sat where you're sitting 11 years ago.
Really?
So, you know, I'll see you in 11 years when you've written a few books of world-changing essays and maybe a novel or two.
Maybe.
Thank you, Tavi Gevinson, very
Thank
much
you.
For being here. Tavi Gevinson is the editor-in-chief of Rookie Magazine, and she is starring in Kenneth Lonergan's play This Is Our Youth, which is on Broadway right now. You gon' touch the sky, baby girl, testify. Come up in the spot looking extra fly. For the day you die, you gon' touch the sky. Still ahead this hour, the jazz composer Maria Schneider does what years of piano lessons did not. Teaches me a little music theory.
Here we go up the hill, back again home.
So it's doing more than chopsticks did for me.
Yeah, yes.
That's Maria Schneider next in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us. This is Studio 360, and I'm Kurt Anderson. At a time when most jazz musicians work in small ensembles of three or four players, Maria Schneider writes big band music and conducts her own jazz orchestra, which has completely redefined the sound of big band music. Schneider grew up in Windom, Minnesota, population 4,600, and you can hear the Midwestern folksiness in her voice, if not necessarily in her music. I was curious about Schneider's creative process, so I paid a visit to her cozy Manhattan apartment/studio. She was just wrapping up a world tour at the time and tweaking the songs on her new album.
So you grew up in this little town in southern Minnesota, in a small town in a rural area. How did you discover music? How did you discover jazz in particular?
Well, my mother played a lot of music around the house. She was a pianist, not a great pianist, but pianist, and we had a lot of records. But it was 1964 when there was a woman that moved to Windom from Chicago. Her name was Evelyn Butler, and she had been a stride pianist and a classical pianist. Her husband and her son both died of cancer within 1 month, and she was, of course, very devastated. And so she went to live with her daughter in Windom and to start teaching piano lessons. And she was this extraordinary pianist. And with an equal love of classical music and stride and the American songbook. And so half of each lesson was showing me standards and and coming up with little stride arrangements.
As a little kid?
Starting at age five. Well, age five is when I started lessons, but my first lesson was a theory lesson. She played a major triad. And then she sang, "Bright the day." And then she sang, "Dark the night." And she said, "Everything in music has a feeling, and I want you to understand why music feels the way it feels, and there's something behind it called music theory."
Wow.
Yeah, and then she went on, in, you know, in music, there's something called the tonic subdominant dominant. It's the 1-4-5, the 1-4-5 chord, which is kind of the basis of all music, and it basically is what makes you feel like you're grounded, and then you're moving away, and then like you've got to come back. And she came up with this. Here we go up the hill, back again home, to show that up the hill is the subdominant.
So it's doing more than chopsticks did for me.
Yeah, yes. The dominant brings you home to tonic. And it was, so she was, without studying any, maybe she did study pedagogy at some point, I don't know.
But she kind of made it up on her own.
I think so.
Wow.
Purely through her own love and understanding. And I think it was because she understood so much about harmony, she looked at her classical pieces always in an analytical way. So as a result, you know, when I came up playing, I fell in love with what was inside the music, the strings that make the marionette show happen rather than the show, you know.
Because you were being taught that at age 5, which is, it's one of those amazing stories of, were it not for her, who knows? I mean, yes, your mother liked music. You were obviously musical, but
I don't know that I would be a musician. Yeah. I mean, I played in the band and I was.
So did I. Look at me.
Yeah, I was musical in a way.
Now, you grew up in the 60s and 70s. Jazz was not exactly fashionable. Big band jazz was certainly not fashionable in your lifetime. I mean, other than loving the music, did you ever think like, whoa, why am I pursuing this thing that is not right now in the sort of mainstream?
You know, it's sort of like I got on a train and I just never got off because it started. I enjoyed the ride somehow, and it always seemed probably not like a good idea, but you know, it's not a good idea to start a big band necessarily. But, you know, it started when I was at the University of Minnesota. A teacher of mine heard I was studying classical composition, and I was listening to so much jazz, and so he heard that influence in my music, and I was probably talking about Gil Evans or Bob Brookmeyer or something. And he said, you know, you should really write for the big band at the school. And I did that, and I just never stopped.
Your big band music, when people have a certain set of expectations based on these big, bright, trumpety, saxy big band music, and people do solos, not so much your music. That clearly was a deliberate, I'm going to do this in a different way than it is customarily done.
It wasn't so much that I wanted to do it in a different way. It happened because of practicality. So when I was in college, what they had for a large jazz ensemble was a big band, you know, 5 reeds, mostly saxophones, 4 brass, and rhythm section. Then I moved to New York and I get to write something for Mel Lewis's band. A group in Europe asks me to write for them. Before you know it, I'm starting to amass this music for big band, except I really kind of wish I was writing for something more orchestral, maybe with double reeds and French horns. So the question was, how do I make this big band not sound and feel like a big band? Because
right,
I don't
right.
want to write big band music,
yeah.
per se.
You don't want it to be nostalgic.
Yeah, nostalgic. And more than that, I didn't want the music always to be that in-your-face blast, which I love sometimes, but I wanted...
Not all the time.
Yeah, I wanted the nuance. Like, Gil, what attracted me to Gil was the nuance, the transparency, the emotion. I wanted that.
So you become a professional musician, move to New York, and get a job with Gil Evans, the famous Gil Evans, who was Miles Davis's arranger, and he was an old man at the time. How did you get that job?
Well, so the real skill that I came to New York with was I was very good at writing out parts in pen and ink, being a music copyist.
Uh-huh.
So now everybody does this on computers.
So this is in the late pre-computer age.
Yeah, so this was starting, let's see, I moved to New York in 1985. And I had the skill, and there were offices in Midtown that were music copying houses.
Really? How 19th century that sounds.
Yeah, oh, it was wonderful. And we'd sit at desks, and we were all sort of, some were old copyists, maybe arrangers that didn't quite totally make it as an arranger or whatever.
So an arranger would arrange his or her music and then send it to the music copy house, and you would by hand write all the parts for all the instruments?
Yes, and we would copy it all out and prepare the score and everything for the recording session. And one day I was Xeroxing a score for a composer named Tom Pearson, and he asked me who my favorite writer was, and I started talking about Gil. And he called me that night and he said, I didn't tell you today, but Gil is one of my closest friends and he needs somebody to do assistant work for him and he wants to meet you. And it was just, I mean, it was a dream of mine because I had wanted to take lessons with Gil, but I was told he didn't really teach, which he didn't. And I had tried calling him, and when I called him, there was a message on the machine and it said,
if you wish to speak to Killer Miles, speak after the beep.
And I thought for sure it had to be Miles Davis, and I freaked out and I hung up. It turned out it was his son, Miles. I found out much later, but it was enough to intimidate me. So it was funny that it would actually happen by chance.
And you're working on a new album now?
I am.
And are you trying particularly new things?
Yeah, I think there are some new things. There's a piece that has sort of a bitonal section where it's called the Thompson Fields, and it's about this farm back home. And I had walked to the top of the silo just a few years back and looking at the bean fields and thinking about all the families that I know, all the
farms. And by beans, we mean soybeans.
Yes, yeah, soybeans, yes. and there's corn and soybeans mainly out there. And just thinking about the generations in our families and the stories and seeing the wind blow across these beans and just feeling the spirits and the layers of life there in the seemingly empty vastness of it all.
Now, how does that, though, when you get back to here, become music?
Well, first of all, when I first start writing something, and I'm this particular song, it first came to me in the laundry room, and it was this. And, so I'll be sitting here writing something like that or hearing something like that, and all of a sudden, as I'm listening to that, I'm transported to on top of that silo.
Uh-huh.
So this particular piece, if I'm just kind of going through here to see if I can find... eventually this moves on and it goes to the key of A flat. And then this B chord starts happening. And the trombones keep hitting this, but at this point, the pianist, Frank, starts playing. Or maybe in the key of... He starts playing in bitonally against this B to somehow get the feeling of these different things happening. And now what I've got in my head is that maybe I'm going to want... the guitar player maybe to start playing an F. I don't know. And then maybe the piano. So that it's almost very Ivesian.
It is.
In its idea.
And when you say you might have the guitarist do this, you don't know yet.
I don't know. I have to talk to him about it, and maybe having him do something with a lot of reverb so it almost feels like there's another tonality in there. I mean, we've been working on this thing for a while, and I'm not quite satisfied yet. So, it's like a work in progress. And the trick is, when you're dealing with improvising musicians, and I want this effect, and I'm not happy until I am sitting on that silo, and I am feeling, and I am seeing all these families and all these my parents' friends who are gone. When I feel that they're there, then I know we've got it and we don't have it yet. So, when I go to my pianist, I say, well, no, it was good. It was good, but it's not right. And I have to try. I have to try to describe what this is that I want.
Next time we see you in the studio, what will you be doing? Will everything be nailed down, locked down? It's just a matter of playing and pushing the buttons?
Well, I sure hope so, but you'll probably see some panicking. And maybe I'll be changing some things in the studio that when I hear, I realize I don't like. You know, every single record has had some crisis that then we ended up coming through, and, you know, I learned a lot.
In the recording process.
Yeah. Huh. Yeah, either something with the sound. For instance, when we did my Concert in the Garden record, it was just so brittle, and it was in the middle of winter, and I think it was very dry, and I think the wood in the walls was dry, and it just made the room sound brittle. And then all of a sudden, I got the idea. I said, everybody, get your coats. We put coats all over the studio, over the floor, in front of every instrument to just try to soak up some of the sound. It really helped.
Huh.
Yeah.
Rhea Schneider, thank you.
Thank you.
See you again.
Thank you.
We'll keep following Maria Schneider through the release of her new album. You can hear more of our interview, for instance, how she crowdfunds her albums and why she testified before Congress against digital piracy at Studio360.org. And that's it for this hour of Studio 360. Thank you very much for listening. And remember to tune in later this month when the actor Alan Cumming takes the reins of Studio 360 for a week. Who knows what might happen?
And I think that's such a great thing about you, that you're always exploding, even within your own oeuvre.
Oh, thank you. I like that whole oeuvre thing.
It's French.
Yeah, I like that French stuff. Very chic.
Maybe I should go away more often. Studio 360 is a co-production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Ital Malad,
David Krasnow,
Jenny Lawton,
John Delore,
Sean Ramisvaram,
Matt Frasica,
Eric Malinsky,
Julia Lowry Henderson,
Shruti Pinnamaneni,
Krista Ripple,
Marshall Bright,
Zoe Azule.
Thanks, as always, to WNYC's Chris Bannon. Our theme music is by David Van Tegum.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360, sometimes movies about science hit a little too close to home.
Watching Gwyneth Paltrow going into a seizure from a viral infection and then having a pathologist cut her skull open, that's pretty gutsy.
Our viruses, ourselves. Next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.